Hi, welcome to Inside Learning, episode 108 for the 27th of March, 2013. Beware of the blob. Steve, indeed felicitations. Here we are at yet another Wednesday night. It's Inside Learning time.
It's Inside Learning time, and it's always grand to be greeted by you on a Wednesday night, Matthew.
You're too
missed
kind.
Missed you last week.
Yeah, well, I guess there's our opener. Big apologies to everyone. It's been a tiring couple of weeks, and I'm guessing that a lot of people in the education business are feeling just the same. Just the run-up to Easter is always tough. People are rushing to get exams and things finished, and I know my diary's been wild. But last week, I was away for a couple of days elsewhere. I know you were away and unavailable as well. So I'm afraid, listeners, there are just occasions when we can't find a backup, and we just have to admit we can't do it.
That's right.
Yeah, I was a little culpable. I didn't put something on the website, but that's partly because I was packing to travel by the time I realised I should do that, and it went out of my mind. So it's a genuine apology, everyone. Sorry about that. However, yeah, we generally try and get a programme out, so... Yeah, here we are again, the old guard tonight.
That's right. And hopefully it just gives people an opportunity to download some of our wonderful back episodes.
That's a very good way of looking at it, absolutely. And we are going to take an Easter break after tonight, of course, so we're going to have 2 weeks break, so people can download even more of our wonderful back episodes.
Mm-hmm. There'll be 107 of them to choose from, so you're not spoilt for choice.
Is this 107 tonight? No, this is 108, is it not?
Is this 108, is
wow.
it?
Wow. Yeah, I can't do the arithmetic, yeah. You ever have those moments where you realise your mouth's just gone faster than your brain?
You're right, this will be 108. We're so prolific, we can't keep up with ourselves.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Anyway, so where will we start? Is there any sports news to get out of the way?
Oh, no. Fiona's quite safe tonight.
good. I believe Scottish football is in some kind of national state of mourning now. I think the carcass has officially been declared beyond help.
Yeah. No, I think we're all in mourning for our lack of spring, I think. You particularly up there.
Well, it's actually worth just saying our colleagues in the Isle of Arran, and particularly for me and my patch here in Argyll in the Kintyre Peninsula, I've had a nightmare. In fact, one of my own colleagues got trapped. She was doing some work in Kintyre before the weekend when the snow fell, and ended up in an unheated bed and breakfast all weekend. She only managed to get back home to Oban on the Sunday later on. So it's been a really tough time, and I understand there might still be a few people not yet connected to the grid.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. I think there's still quite a few lines down.
Yeah. Anyway, so shall we get into some kind of a... So it's interesting with Easter coming and the financial year end and so many things happening about exam changes and stuff in Scotland. I've been reflecting a lot in the last week, trying to figure whether we're coping with the pace of change. And it's interesting, because we talk so much about the English and the Scottish system and Inside Learning... Yeah, sometimes I generalise about how the mood is, depending on what's happening in Scotland, but I guess what I'm really asking is, what's the mood in England at the moment?
Quite depressing. I'll start off, first of all, just from an anecdotal point of view. I was teaching some young students who were going through a master's course the other evening, a week or so back. And just, as you chat during a break or beforehand, hearing some really depressing stories about things going on in their schools, from the way they're being, the only way I can put it is terrorized by some of their leadership teams, who are in turn, I think, being terrorized by the specter of Ofsted. For example, there was one guy said that they'd been in two schools are combined, I think, into a new academy, so they'd been re-inspected. But teachers who had been previously kind of cast as good or outstanding by Ofsted were now being cast as inadequate, you know, and the whole ball game seems to have changed. And the teachers saying, yeah, we got, you know, senior management coming around all the time with clipboards and saying your lesson's inadequate and not giving us any coaching or support as to why. And all of a sudden, you know, where before we thought we were doing all right, now all of a sudden we're all being kind of told we're no good. This a lot of this drive seems to be coming from, you know, Ofsted generated accountability, and heads, you know, some heads and senior leadership teams seem to be trying to exert a huge amount of control through these auditing procedures, but they're not actually giving anybody any development or coaching as to how they might improve. And ironically, one of the teachers said, yeah, we just had an inspection and the heads of department have been coming around telling us that we're inadequate. We're also graded inadequate by Ofsted as well. So kind of huge credibility gap. And it seems that a lot of people were really demoralized about what's going on in their schools. You know, they just felt it wasn't the job that they came in to do. They're uncertain as to where the new curriculum changes are going. They just feel they're being pressured all the time, that you know, they've been told they're inadequate. It's no way to run a public service. As I say, this is just an anecdotal impression, but a very strong impression.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would reflect that north of the border. I've been speaking to quite a few teaching colleagues recently as well, and certainly in the primary sector, there's a lot more confidence about the changes. You know, we have a lot of pressure here to deliver as well. HMI in Scotland have upped the ante. What they've done is, over the last year, they've put out a document outlining the raised expectation of inspection, and it's now tougher than ever to get a good inspection. Now, on one hand, I think that's laudable. You know, that, you know, if education is about anything in a changing, you know, world environment, then it's about raising standards and improvement. So I can kind of get that. But in the secondary sector, we have a lot of teachers who are just demoralised. I think that's not too strong. You know, they feel as if they're working away to write new courses. Different schools are actually implementing different versions of the new national curriculum. So it's hard for them to share work, you know, and, you know, cut the workload. Inspections are delivering downgrades for a lot of people. Not as dramatic as you're saying, mind you. You know, to be told you're inadequate is a horrendous thing. That, you know, that's a good thing, drives people to go home and slit their wrists. You know, we don't have anything like that. But certainly we're seeing people, you know, who maybe in an inspection 6 or 7 years ago were seeing, you know, the very goods and the excellence as they grade the, you know, the top performers here, you know, suddenly just making the satisfactory and goods, you know, it's,
yeah,
you know, there's a real sense that people have, I'm remembering that Guinness advert, you know, with the Sisyphean character pushing the stone up the hill, you know, it feels a wee bit like that for teachers just now. It's, you know, every time they think they got to the top, somebody just plucks them to the bottom and puts the stone in front of them again. So I'm a little bit torn because I, you know, I'm no apologist for bad standards. If the standards are no good, then, you know, then let's work on them. But there is a sense, if I'm summarising it, that we don't quite know how to improve schools just now.
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot in that, Matthew. And there's certainly, you know, something to be said for public accountability, and Ofsted in principle could do a good job of providing good data about what's going on in our schools. But unfortunately, I think it's the way that, as you said, the ante's been upped without really anybody in the profession knowing what's going on and how it's been upped. Say teachers saying, well, you know, last term I was good. I was told I was good. Now I'm suddenly told I'm inadequate and I don't know what I've done differently. And the other thing I think that to remember about Ofsted is they're only taking a snapshot of these teachers, as are the senior leadership team, who go in with their clipboards and do these observations. And if you're talking about improvement, we've got to take a kind of long-term view, haven't you? You've got to start sort of triangulating data, to use the jargon.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to look at what are young people saying? How are the results going? What do a series of observations do? You know, what are kind of heads of department or the teachers themselves saying? You know, you've got to combine a range of data to see how standards have improved. And I think those schools that do really well obviously have far more sort of coaching and personal development work for teachers.
Well, that's a nice link into the other part of what you said there, which is that people aren't getting much development work. I don't know about south of the border, but budgets are being cut very dramatically north of the border. And as a result of that, you know, the kind of training and development that would help people stay abreast of the new approaches that HMI or Ofsted are looking for are first to go, you know, when you're looking for savings. So we're raising the ante, doing, as far as I can see, just as much inspection as ever, but we're not putting the training and the input in, as David Cameron keeps on saying to us, the real David Cameron, you know, that we keep on thinking, particularly south of the border, that, you know, changing the governance will fix everything. Now, it smacks of weighing the pig a little bit at the moment. You know, that we're not feeding it. You know, we're just simply weighing it. I know it's probably the cheesiest of cliches, I think, that we've ever taken resort to. The last refuge of a podcasting scoundrel, but weighing the pig does pop into the consciousness, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah.
But another thing that struck me, my excellent colleague Anne Patterson, who you'll remember as a former podcast guest, it's time she was getting back on board with the podcast. But she and I were talking this week, you know, in this reflective mood that I think I'm in about this, because this is our business as well. You know, we're in the business of school improvement, although we're not inspectors. And actually, you know, you realise that as the worlds get more complex, what Graham Lester said to us, you know, so often on his guest spots on the podcast, Graham Lester of International Futures Forum, is that as it gets more complex, we have to learn more. We have to move into a learning mode, you know, and... Yeah, this weighing the pig approach doesn't seem quite consistent with it. And as a result of that, we had a look at some info online, and I just reminded myself of how we got where we are. Because you know how it is, unless you're actually doing research or a PhD or something, Steve, you know, you don't you don't keep up to date with this stuff all the time. So anyway, a quick read on the history of school improvement. And it's fascinating, you know, that the articles I was reading from people like Louise Stahl, who were doing the, you know, review of the field, were basically making the assertion that school improvement as a kind of a modern art really only started with the teacher as researcher work in the 80s, and then moved on to the school, what's it called? School improvement, but also
school of effectiveness.
That's it. And that those two programs were separate.
Different.
You know, they weren't programs, different. But they were kind of movements, weren't they?
So paradigms, if you
like. Oh, paradigms. That's more like it. You're trying to rescue my pulling down of the podcast into the gutter with my weighing the pig, you know, with paradigm again. Yeah, this is the way to go. But actually, you know, through the 90s and the noughties, you had Macbeth, Mortimer, and lots of the London boroughs, you know, looking at variously, you know, how do you check if a school is effective, you know, and things like value-added measures and trying to eliminate for background factors. And what struck me is that the research is really, really difficult. They didn't find it easy to say how you would say how effective a school is. And I, to get to the point now, I thought, well, isn't it time then that we were going back to look at that work again and saying how, you know, how can we really be confident in saying a school is adding value now? And the stark juxtaposition here, moving from paradigm quickly to juxtaposition again, is that we do these inspections in a few days. So how confident can we be that we've got that right?
Yeah,
I'm not for one moment wanting to suggest that, you know, that, you know, we should throw out inspection, you know, as a, you know, on grounds of accuracy or anything like that, because I'm sure that they call it broadly right. But very arrogant about it, and they tend to sort of call a set of grades as though they really understand. It's like your snapshot thing there.
Yeah.
And yet, when you read that research, you know, the decades of it, you know, the couple of decades of it there, and the difficulties that they had bringing school effectiveness and school improvement together, you suddenly wonder how HMI and Ofsted can be so confident that they've got it right now.
In fact,
to be fair to them, I suspect that they know they haven't, but I suspect that it's a juggernaut. They have to keep doing it while they keep, you know, while they learn. It's, you know, rebuilding the aircraft while they fly it. But they haven't dropped that arrogant ability to really demoralise teachers if it's going badly.
No, that's right, and that's kind of linked to that, to the political pressures that, you know, I think it kind of funnels down. The thing about the audit system that we have currently, the lack of trust just is passed on down the line.
Yeah. You know,
and I think the thing that's interesting about school effectiveness research is I don't know if there's how much agreement there is on the effect size of schools. So, for example, you know, some people will say, well, schools can impact as little as 5% on a child's life chances. Others will say, well, maybe the figure's nearer 15 or 20%. The school effectiveness research into teaching suggests that a good, effective teachers can make 25% of difference to a young person's outcomes and lives. So that still leaves a huge amount of young people's lives that actually effectively outside the control of schools.
Yeah.
And there's some interesting research. I mean, a number of different research projects have been done on this, but there was one by Amanda Sackler and colleagues at the London School of Medicine who did some, and they say it's a bit, you know, it's not totally valid and reliable. You know, it's quite crude in some of its measures, but they were looking at the relationship between social class and outcomes. And they did a kind of, they took a 7, 11, and 16, and they said they looked at various factors like material deprivation, parental aspirations, and so on, the neighborhood effects, and so on. But they're basically saying, you know, by the time a young person got to 16, the parents had actually little effect on the outcomes for young people. It was the peer group and the state of the neighborhood that had a major impact.
Wow.
And schools, you know, good schools can maybe make sort of, 25%. Difference if we want to put a percentage figure on.
Well, the ICEP Improving School Effectiveness Program always said it was 15 was the largest effect size they measured.
Yeah.
But then that's you know, near to the year 2000. That's about out of date now.
Yeah, but like you said, I don't know how we start to really unravel this because there's so many variables in this. We can obviously say that good schools make a difference, but there has to be other things in place as well.
Yeah. And I guess one of the things that worries me here is that I almost sound like I'm an apologist for schools. You know, it sounds like I'm kind of saying lay off the poor teachers. You know, they're not being given enough training and support, and you know, this is demoralising and frightening them, which I suppose I am. But actually, simultaneously, I'm very demanding as well. You know, I mean, the whole raison d'être of this podcast and my, you know, my work and my passion for that is that I don't think schools are doing enough to tackle, you know, the incredibly difficult challenges that young people are going to face now. I just don't think we're doing it the right way. I don't think you frighten people into, you know, into new thinking and improvement. Nor do you move people into new thinking by constantly kind of weighing them against a standard. You know, and saying, well, that's the way it should be done generally just now in the best places. So why are you not doing that? Now, I know that inspection's moved a bit beyond that, and it's not fair for me to cast it in that light. But there's a need now for an agency like the Inspectorate or Ofsted to be putting out a different message, a much more learning-focused message. You know, I think we're ready now for them to admit that they don't know the answers. And, you know, they could simultaneously go back to saying, look, we know crap when we see it. We're going to tell you if your kids are unhappy or unsafe, or if your teachers have got bad beliefs that are, you know, holding kids back. But simultaneously, if we're serious about moving into an era when we're going to share that knowledge, as you say, Ofsted have got a lot of good knowledge around, you know, what they're seeing in different schools. But if we're going to humbly share that with the academic community and engage with them in a way that they haven't for a long time and try and figure out new interesting approaches, then I welcome it. I just don't see them being ready yet politically to do that.
Well, that's interesting you should say that about the sharing and being willing and ready to do it politically, because it brings me on to the kind of main story I picked up on. And I got this via various Twitter links, but because I have to say, folks, I don't normally read this newspaper, and it certainly wouldn't be in my outhouse.
I can't wait. Where are we going?
Shining up my backside. But the Daily Mail... Michael Gove wrote an article in the Daily Mail saying, I refuse to surrender to the Marxist teachers hell-bent on destroying our schools.
Do you know, I actually went to Ladbrokes and asked if I could get odds on you bringing that up in tonight's podcast, where they said, mate, it's one-on-one, the odds, we're not giving it, it's not worth it.
you'd be paying out on it, yeah.
Exactly.
You'd be paying them to take the bet, yeah, I know. But, well, because... I don't want to go into the detail of his proposals and the curriculum reforms, because there may be things in it, you know, we could sort of say, okay, fair enough. And I, in some ways, I admire his passion and belief in the what he's doing. It's the way that he's actually the discourse is just not prepared to engage. And the way he just slags off anybody who kind of disagrees with him, it just smacks of, as I said before, of Stalinism. But it's just a brilliant kind of, brilliant, no, that's the wrong word. I mean, it left me speechless reading this. But he said, because it basically has a go at these academics who wrote, there's 100 academics who signed a letter to the Independent criticizing his curriculum proposals.
Would these 100 academics be the blob?
That's right, the blob.
You better explain
indeed.
That.
Yeah. Well, actually, the blob, for those of you who love bad 50s sci-fi B-movies, and I was kind of, I don't remember seeing The Blob when it came out, but The Blob was actually a film, I think, in which a blob landed from outer space. I think Steve McQueen, was it Steve McQueen's first film? Anyway.
I'm impressed that you know that.
Yeah, well, there you go. You see, I used to have a thing about bad 50s sci-fi movies.
Like Plan B from outer space?
Yes, the ones where you see the hubcap passing. The
yeah. I know we're digressing here, but now you've taken this. What was the one that they replaced the actor halfway when he's walking across a field because he died?
Oh, yeah.
Was that Plan B from outer space?
It could have been.
It's like Boris Karloff or something like that. You know, he's lumbering across the field, then suddenly cut. There's a new actor lumbering across the field.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Boris Karloff is usually a star in some of these things. No, actually, but he sent in his article, school reformers in the past often complained about what was called the blob, the network of educational gurus in and around our universities who praised each other's research, sat on committees that drafted politically correct curricula, drew gifted young teachers away from their vocation and instead directed them towards ideologically driven theory. So this is the blob. So in the past, he says, the blob tended to operate by stealth, using its influence to control the quangos and committees which shape policy. But the blob has broken cover in the letter pages of the broadsheets because this government is taking it on. We have abolished the quangos they controlled. We have given a majority of secondary schools academy status, so they are free from the influence of the blob's allies in local government. We are moving teacher training away from university departments and into our best schools, and we are reforming our curriculum exams to restore the rigor they abandon. So, yeah, essentially, basically, he slagged all his critics off as enemies of promise. They're part of the blob, and they're all Marxists, so we're not going to pay any attention to them. So any serious points they make about, you know, the fact that we might be ramming spellings down their throat in a way that his beloved Finland don't, he's not prepared to engage with any of that. It's unfortunately, so this coming back to your point, which started me off on that little rant, Matthew, was that somehow in politically we don't have any means or it seems the willingness to talk to each other about what might constitute evidence and how we assess it.
And as the, you know, the guy that's setting the standard for English education, well, at least who should be, is making that impossible. You know, he's setting barriers up. He's setting opposition up. I thought it was a horrible piece, and my immediate instinct when I read it, having picked up the Twitterati, having a bit of a rummel about it. You were very unhappy on Twitter, weren't they? Was that we really should have got Laurie on this week to talk about it, because the last time when he did his interesting but bizarre speech, you know, aligning himself with Gramsci and left wing ideological, you know, thinking, it sort of reminded me of that. You know, this is another one of these attacks, you know, that's full of interesting things. You know, it's actually a little bit of me resonated with that. I thought, yeah, do you know what? There is a body of reactionary academics out there who pretty much have become comfortable in the idea that they'll do lots of small-scale research that doesn't change the world, doesn't rock anyone's boat, and they're not really interested in seeing radical change in education. But actually, the way he put it was to suddenly tar them all with the same brush, you know, and he now has to get round the table with academics, many of whom who actually have genuinely great analysis and great answers that will help move us forward, and they're not going to trust anything he does or says, and why should they?
That's the problem, and I was looking at the list of signatories, you know, and there's quite a few of those which I would say have been kind of deeply involved in researching school improvement and school effectiveness in the past, you know, like Professor Mel Ainsco, who was at Manchester.
Oh, we've got a phone buzz, Steve. Your phone isn't here, is it?
Don't think so. I should. No, says he, quickly turning it off. But, you know, he's picked up the CV of a couple of people and then damned the whole lot of them by association. And these are people who've kind of dedicated their life to try to get a scholarly analysis and actually work for a better schooling system. And it's this kind of complete lack of trust in anybody throughout the system. And it's ironic, isn't it? I mean, he calls them, you know, ideological enemies of improvement, when actually he's himself is promoting an ideological position.
Well, I'm really drawn to Senge's thinking here. Peter Senge always says that the way to go is to take a systems view of these things. You know, if education's not moving forward in the ways that we want it to, let's look at the system. You know, don't blame the blob or, you know, some other blanket thing like, you know, Marxist teachers, you know. I mean, it's complete nonsense anyway. I would imagine the amount of teachers that can actually tell what a Marxist actually is
absolutely
in 2012 are probably thin in the ground. So the idea that they'd be aligning themselves with this ideology that's...
I know. I mean, when you kind of first entered into schools, you know, the end of the 70s or beginning of the 80s, you could have probably found Marxist teachers in any school you went into. And, you know, I have to say that a lot of these teachers were highly dedicated to what they did. You know, were often very good teachers. But now, I mean, you'd be surprised. You know, I'd be surprised if you talked to a recent graduate. They probably might have difficulty kind of saying anything about Marx. You know, who he?
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Groucho or Carol, I think they'd probably struggle to say anything about that. They're both of the wrong vintage, yeah. So... Yeah. Utter nonsense. But one of the things I wanted to pick up on tonight was that his schools minister, your schools minister, David Laws, is it?
Yeah.
What a conciliatory, sensible piece he wrote about teachers being blamed. It was almost like an anti-piece. Did you see that?
No, I didn't see that one, no.
I need to look for it now. I know I was skimming the news this morning, but he wrote something about saying that, you know, sometimes, I'm paraphrasing here, he said something like, politicians talk as though they have a monopoly on the desire to improve children's futures, something like that. I thought, bloody well said, you know. He was humble, he was sensible, he was saying, you know, we really need to, you know, be more balanced than that and be more sensible than that. And it suddenly struck me, I thought, yeah, right enough, you're the schools minister, why do we not hear more of him?
Yes.
You know, Gove is not helping the case here, you know. We gave him praise occasionally, and sometimes he deserves it. He is a genuine reformer, he's genuinely radical. Clearly he's getting a lot of things wrong, and he's clearly getting a few things right, but... Honestly, I don't think even the people that were open to, you know, to listening to his better ideas are going to take him very seriously after this kind of talk. Whereas David Laws might be the guy to be bringing forward if the government's serious about moving things.
Mm. And there's another sentence that really jarred here. He's playing this, oh yeah, I come from a poor, humble, working class background. You know, he says, because of my own background, I'm determined to do everything I can to help the poorest children in our country transcend theirs. Well, excuse me, but didn't he go to a private school? Wasn't his, you know, weren't his school fees paid for by somebody? You know, it's this kind of, it's this prolier than thou, Tony's taking.
Prolier than thou. I think we've got an episode title. Thank heavens you've saved us from Wake the Pig.
Well, Beware of the Blob, wasn't it?
Beware of the Blob. Hey, we're rich in possible titles tonight.
Yeah. I believe, I've just looked the film up, but it's, I believe Burt Bacharach wrote a song called Beware of the Blob for the film. So.
Really? You know your film cheese, that's really impressive. Anyway, so I think we can put that to bed. So Gove has excelled himself there, hasn't he, in terms of sheer madness.
Where we started this conversation, the theme of the cast tonight, it seems to be, we started off with an anecdote, and we're going into but the notion is that actually there are a lot of demoralised people out there. Mm. This kind of political intervention does not help.
No.
Raise the morale of the profession. But it also, the deeper point that I think we're trying to get to is that we need some more considered evidence about how we can improve or change schools. And in the current climate, the current kind of tick box, clipboard, terrorized teachers sort of inspection climate, we're not actually going to get that sort of evidence.
No, I absolutely agree. And if there is a call for anything here, it's perhaps even a new body, to bring school improvement back together. Something like National College has done for leadership, because I think they've done a genuinely good job for leadership, albeit, in such a diffuse way over the years that I'm not sure you could point to any one single thing they've done, but they've certainly done a lot of work that was good at bringing together real school leader experiences with academics.
Yes, I was probably Gove would dismiss that as vapid happy talk, but I mean, they.
What was his other phrase from that particular one?
It was rhetorical afflatus.
Rhetorical afflatus.
Yes, excellent.
Oh, dear. Yeah. Anyway, I would like to see a body like that pulled together for school improvement. Yeah. And I'm thinking about our wee creativity exercise from a few weeks ago when. I was floating the idea that maybe it's time to have schools run not by local authorities or even this idea of self-governed, but instead to have a national schools body that was independent, like the Bank of England. They're the kind of people that could actually calmly and sensibly pull together the researchers and the practitioners.
Mm, yeah.
Anyway, any day now the phone will go, Steve, and we'll be asked to chair that. They'll need you at the head of it because you're a doctor now. Well, we actually haven't picked up on any stories except the obvious Gove one tonight, and there we are at half an hour already. Amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. Actually, it's interesting just reflecting on how we both came across this story. Was because, as I said, I wouldn't shine my backside on the Daily Mail, but the we came across it through Twitter, and there was an increasing number of teachers and educators who are using Twitter, but also writing their own blogs. Some really interesting blogs out there. I was kind of speculating on the kind of public servants going public, And
this is nice a link as we've ever managed, yeah. Because I had an interesting experience earlier this week. One of the reasons that I couldn't do the podcast last week is I was off getting an interview, and it was one of these long processes. It wasn't a single day interview. It was three different days, three different events thing. Quite a senior job. And I didn't get it, I hasten to add. But what was really interesting is in the middle of the process on chatting with the director of this particular education authority, he said, doing a lot of work on the candidates for this, we want to know who we're getting. And he said to me, in your case, that's not been difficult. and of course, right enough, I podcast. Within the podcast, if you do a search in the pages, you'll find that I've occasionally blogged as well. And if you wanted to know my beliefs in education, if you spent a few hours online, you're going to get a tremendous amount. I'm not particularly private either in that my photography is on my photography website as well. There's nothing there I'm worried about or ashamed of having online, it's stuff that I'm happy to put there. But it's an interesting question, isn't it? I'm a public servant. I work in the school improvement business for a local authority, and I suppose perhaps aspire to become more senior. And I'm thinking about Don Ledingham, the director of the Scottish Authority, East Lothian. And I think up till recently he was also covering for Mid Lothian as the director of education, who blogs regularly. And in fact, his blog is one that I particularly enjoy. Is he's very well connected. He connects with educators on Twitter and through his other network connections, from other education authorities or even other nations, and reflects publicly on what it's making him think. And he'll put questions up there, things he doesn't know the answer to, or say, what would happen if we did and how would this be? And I think he's inspirational. I think it's absolutely wonderful because it ties in with what we've just been talking about, doesn't it? That we've got too many people saying, I know the right way to do this, and therefore you are satisfactory, excellent, inadequate, weak, whatever, In actual fact, I love his approach, which is, I'm not quite sure what the right answer is, but I want to engage my colleagues that I work with in a in a debate that we can be proud of our professionalism and know that, you know, that what we're doing for young people is trying to learn as fast as we can as the world changes, you know. I think that's super. So I guess what I'm saying is that I think it's quite good to do stuff like blogging and podcasting, even as a, you know, as a senior kind of officer in public service. But I guess there is a debate about that, because you can give a lot of hostages to fortune as well. You know, when this guy said, "I've been listening to your podcast," I thought, oh my God, you know, you know, I hope it's one of the good episodes, because the truth is that in some of the good episodes, I'm very proud of what we've tried to contribute to education. And I'm sure there's a few in there that are thinking, oh my God, we got a bit carried away with that joke, you know. But overall, I'm glad you gave me a chance to talk about that there. I think it's time for people to get brave. People expect open communication these days, and I think we're ready for it.
Yeah, and it is the way of the world now. But, you know, it's so commonplace, isn't it, that you can't. I suppose you just have to engage in it in the spirit of learning. And I guess, I mean, I suppose if I was doing a sort of prose, if we were going back to the Edward de Bono kind of hats thing, if I put on the negative hat, it's just whether there's so many voices out there and they're so disparate, you know, that actually it all gets lost. It's just a few people. Well, it's just somebody else sounding off. Do you sort of mean?
Yeah.
That would be my negative hat about it. I mean, in terms of the sort of green hat thinking, then the more debate and dialogue we can get going, the more we can learn together. It's just how do you pull that through as a community? And I suppose people like the Pedagoo and the Teach Meets are starting to bring those to cohere around some sort of improvement program, aren't they, through pedagogy?
I think so. I'd like to think some of our, you know, really great future leaders are going to come from, you know, that Pedagoo kind of background, you know. And, you know, I think Don Lidingham is leading the way. You know, he's showing us how that can be done. He's very good at it, though, because he asks questions. He's very circumspect. Possibly if we have a vulnerability on inside learning, it's that we're quite opinionated.
Yeah. Well,
moi? Yeah. But then I guess there's a difference between blogging and podcasting. In a blog, you tend to take the time to put a considered opinion, you know, and, you know, you can put both sides. Whereas, you know how chuffed I was when our young colleague, Paul Campbell, wasn't it, from Strathclyde University, a student teacher, came on and he said, "It's good to be on the show." You know, I was delighted. I thought, we've got a show. This is great. So I guess there's a bit of entertainment in this as well. And maybe that's not so compatible. Interesting question there.
It's an interesting question, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I think I was just drawing a parallel with the NHS and the press sort of scandals of recent days. You know, the stronger the public culture is, then surely the better public service can be accountable to that. And if that means that public servants have to go online and be public, then so be it, you know. I'm just thinking in terms of, say, the NHS, you know, that this culture of people, whistleblowers, were sort of gagged, weren't they, or prosecuted. You know, obviously we don't get to a kind of, hopefully we're not at a whistleblowing stage where there's kind of matters of life and death, but there are certainly critical concerns that we ought to be discussing and raising. And therefore public servants ought to have the freedom to do that. The press one's interesting because, you know, where does it stop? I mean, are we part of the press now? You know, are we kind of, is inside learning in its own tiny way going to be subject to any regulation? Do you see what I mean? I mean, where do you draw the boundaries on the kind of the blogosphere?
Yeah, I think there aren't any boundaries, and as ever, you know, like Larry Downes said in his amazing book, you know, The Law of Disruption, you know, the law is now unable to keep up with technology, you know, so you could put out, you know, legislation about freedoms or limitations on the press, but does it apply to inside learning, as you say? I don't know. You know, we're not journalists, but we're actually, you know, well, I was going to say we're broadcasting, strictly we're narrowcasting, aren't we? But we're casting anyway, one way or another.
And we're promoting news, we're discussing topical content in the way that, you know, a paper might.
And we might even be influencing people.
might.
you didn't have to raise your eyebrows like that there in such such amazement. But really?
Look round for the dog, though, wasn't one.
Oh, dear. Anyway, listen, this is a pre-holiday episode. So any other quick news things before we bring this baby into land?
No, I think I was just left speechless by the...
The golfster.
The tone of an education secretary who's meant to be promoting learning and dialogue.
Yeah, well, I'm really sorry for you that you're working in that environment there. Right, before holiday time then, we're going to take two weeks break on Inside Learning. I know a lot of schools are going to be getting holidays. It's so hard these days because, holidays are varying all over the country, but Easter itself hasn't moved that much over the country. So, at least some part of our 2 weeks should coincide with some other teachers or educators.
Yep.
Any reading recommendations for them?
Oh, do you mean any reading?
Anything, yeah. That was a good play for time, mind you. Yeah, that's what I'd have done.
Yeah. Well, I've just finished a book, which is not a recent book, but I've just got into Sebastian Faulks' work.
Oh.
And it's The Fool's Alphabet. And it's quite a sort of gentle story of someone working through their life, finding themselves. So I can recommend Sebastian Faulks' writing.
Right. Is he the guy that did Birdsong?
Yeah.
Yeah, I read that and I thoroughly enjoyed that. That was really good. So I could add to that, but I've never read anything else, so maybe I should pick up one of those. Tell me, am I imagining this? Did Sebastian Faulks also write a Bond book?
No, he might have been. Was he one of the later ones? Yeah, because they hauled some writers in, haven't they, to carry on the...
Yeah. Right, I'm going to have to look this up now.
I think you're right, yep. Anyway, what about you in terms of reading?
It's so hard because the book I've just finished I thought was quite ordinary, enjoyable and probably worth a read, but ordinary. David Lodge, I'm a big fan of David Lodge. Haven't read him for a long time. He wrote Small World and Changing Places or Trading Places?
Yeah.
About the university world and kind of, as you put it, gently poking fun at that. But he's written one just recently called Deaf Sentence with an F. About an elderly academic. It's always about academics in his books. Not elderly, sorry, a retired, just aging academic who's losing his hearing and about the various things that happened to him. In the end, it's probably a bit of a damp squib of a book. It becomes a kind of a contemplative, slightly interesting, a situation the man's in. It just all resolves itself neatly in a kind of is that what that was all about kind of a way. So I'm not sure I'll go as far as to recommend it. If you're a David Lodge fan, you'll enjoy it just fine, but I don't think it's a wonderful one. I guess what I would do is I would recommend, if someone feels like something a bit different, why not go and get yourself into the Honor Harrington books if you feel like a bit of sci-fi. Honor Harrington, and the reason I recommend that is you can get the first two free, written by I can't remember the guy's name now. It'll come to me. I need to look that up. Anyway, Honor Harrington is based on, would you believe, Horatio Hornblower. The H in H is not a coincidence. She's a future space captain, who rises up through the ranks in a very far future, a sort of 23rd or later century world, 25th century, something like that. And it's just great. If you like your sci-fi, it's a ripping yarn in every book, all quite incredible, seat of the pants stuff. And there are about 14 or 15 novels so far and he hasn't finished writing them. I'll put the link. I can't remember the author's name. I'll put the link up there. But if you're looking for something that's free and you can decide whether you like it or not, if you don't like sci-fi, you won't like it. But if you do, it's really pretty good. It's well written. There's a few things that are just a bit far-fetched, but gripping stuff.
Yeah, Sebastian Faulks did write a Bond novel.
Oh, I'm still looking that up and I haven't hit the search.
Devil May Care.
Devil May Care.
2008, yeah.
Wow, I haven't read that one.
But he's got a huge range of books, and I think they're all beautifully written. They're all worth taking time on. And
Actually, I went through a wee thing recently about reading a couple of the new Bond ones, or the post Ian Fleming ones, and I'm just wondering if I actually did read that.
But
no, I'm not sure. No, I'll need to. I need to get my Kindle out. I don't know about you. Sometimes I have to actually get out and look to see what's on my list. Oh, I'll tell you what I read recently at the recommendation of one of our guests. You remember the excellent Alison Drever that was on recently? She recommended that I read The Night Circus by Erin Morgenstern.
Right, yep.
That's an interesting read. I would probably pass that recommendation on. I don't think I could say I enjoyed it, but it was one of the more interesting and unusual books I've ever read. It's a book that I described on Twitter to her as being utterly soulless.
Really?
It's
I've
a
just bought
cold,
it.
You've just bought it?
Yeah, for Linda's birthday, just as a...
Oh, right. She doesn't listen to the podcast, does she? I don't have to be careful not to have any spoilers. It's an incredibly interesting and rich book. You know, it weaves a world that's quite lovely to read about. But it has no purpose or point really discernible in it. It's kind of a love story, but it's a cold, almost soulless love story. Strange. You finish it and you think, yeah, I did enjoy that, but I'm not sure really what I got from it.
All right. Okay.
Okay, so there we go. Some holiday thoughts. Give me one more moment. I feel really guilty. Hold on. Sorry? I have to look it up. I can't just leave it like that. I need this author's name, don't I?
Sort the author's name out. So anyway, hopefully we've given Joyce enough broadcasting time to go to sleep on tonight. I think she missed us the other night.
It's David Weber.
David Weber,
yep. Okay, sorry about that. Yeah, hopefully. Sorry about that, Joyce.
Right.
Okay, so we'll get our guests lined up for a couple of weeks away.
Hopefully, I think I might have somebody who's currently a primary deputy head or is acting head. So hopefully get Louisa on to talk about the primary curriculum reforms in England. I'm hoping that'll be lined up for a couple of weeks' time.
That sounds fantastic. Well, you know, when Gove phones then to say, look, get me on this podcast to defend myself, as he will, tell him he has to wait till the week after then.
Yes, absolutely.
he might be thinking about it because, as you know, he will listen and then he'll see that we've had David Cameron on anyway and he'll think, oh, well, yes, I better get myself on this.
Sorry, he was on Question Time the other night and he's very, very self-assured and... He said, oh, I know, I don't see myself as a future leader. You know, I know my place. You have to know one's place in life. And working closely with David, I can see what it takes. And I haven't got what it takes. And I'm thinking,
firm denial. David Cameron is probably running right now to undermine his career now that he realizes that's as much as saying, I'm going for it.
Yeah.
Anyway, I guess we better move on. Been great to talk with you tonight. Again, big apologies to people that missed us last week. We missed you too, guys. And we'll see you shortly after the break.
Right. Good night, Matthew.
Good night, Steve. Break.